Welcome to Marketing Musicology with your host, Dr. David Allen.
Today we're lucky to be talking to Dr. Moore. Dr. Moore is responsible for Deep Note, probably the most influential one-note audio logo maybe in the history of audio logos. Very nice to have you here today, Dr. Moore.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I'm not going to make you tell the story again. I'm assuming that everyone knows it at this point, but now 27, 28 years later from the first one, what are your thoughts after all these years that we are still, people like me and others are still talking about it as one of the best?
Well, it has legs and a persistence that I didn't imagine. I mean, that's one of the things you shoot for, of course, is to make something so gripping that people can't get it out of their head. Although it's funny because it's not something you can whistle exactly.
Why do you think it's been so powerful? Could you imagine sitting there and that day then creating this note that it would have transcended all these decades?
Well, I had a hint of it when I first started playing it around Lucasfilm, because people would go out and call other people to come in and listen to it. They're a tough audience. So that was my first hint that this thing had some power to it. Well, plus, I remember when I was first asked about it, you've heard this part of the story, but I'll say it again to make a point. He came up and said, "I want something that comes out of nowhere and gets really, really big." And I thought I knew exactly what he wanted. And, you know, from my musical studies and training, I knew what he wanted was a just a tempered chord. So that's what I built. That is a cluster, a random cluster that converged. It builds up to this just tempered chord. I've had a number of comments that the chord seems bigger than life or bigger than normal or not like a chord that you would hear from an organ, even though that was sort of the idea. It was supposed to be sort of like a great big organ chord, but with a just tempered organ, which I haven't been built in quite some time.
And the he being Lucas, of course.
No. It was delegated. George has a policy of hiring from within or promoting from within. So when it came time to bring out the THX sound system, he wanted something to go in front of the film that announced that you were listening to a THX sound system. And so he delegated it to one of the up-and-coming sort of middle managers. He said, he threw him the idea and said, you make a 30-second logo to go in front of... it was Return of the Jedi in 1983. And as I say, he put together this lovely video, this beautiful video animation. And he didn't say this, but I think what happened was that he spent all the money on the animation, didn't have any money left over for the audio. And since I was on salaried staff there, I didn't cost anything. So he went and pitched it to me. Lucas actually didn't hear it until quite a bit later. I've never asked George about it, but clearly it made an impression because they scrambled around and to copyright it shortly after it came out.
I'm sure the number of times it's played at this point would be quite lucrative if you had rights to that one note, I guess.
Well, except that nobody pays to play that, right?
That's true.
In fact, we pay them to play it.
That's very true. You know, sensory marketing being as big as it is, this is probably one of the few sonic notes that you actually hear and feel, you know?
Yeah, that was sort of the intention. I mean, I was working closely with Tom Holman, who designed the THX system. And when he told me how many watts he had behind the screen there, I thought, oh boy, here's our big chance. Anything that can deliver, you know, that much power. I mean, in a big studio, a big theater, it'd be something like 3,500 watts of audio, and quite a bit of that in the subwoofer. So I figured, well, boy, here's my chance to, you know, shake the rafters.
It's not only entertaining if you're in the seat, but if you're out in the hallway, it alerts you that the movie's starting, right?
I suppose so. Yes, can't miss it.
So how does someone get from a PhD at Stanford and degrees at MIT into a studio creating sound logos?
Well, I've always been a musician, and I've always been an engineer. I wasn't quite a good enough musician to make that a career. I did take a bunch of courses at our local music school at Florida State in Tallahassee, which is quite a large music school. But the number of unbelievable musicians that came through the place just convinced me that I was in way over my head. So I got into MIT and thoroughly enjoyed it there. That is, it was like a fire hose of knowledge and information, and the incredible milieu. All the professors around you have, you know, publication lists as long as your arm, and it was quite a few of them were very generous with their time, and it was a wonderful environment. I learned quite a bit. After that, I got a job as a professional programmer at Stanford. But the interesting thing there was that I worked at the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab, where there was a group of musicians that were professors at Stanford, composers that were using the computer to make music. I found this absolutely fascinating, and helped out as much as I could. And then I did get admitted to, after working there for about 3 years, I did get admitted to the graduate school in computer science there. And I did a thesis with the music group there. In fact, it was a kind of a triple major, that is computer science, electrical engineering, and music. That is, my thesis committee consists of one EE prof, one computer science professor, and one music professor. And it was on transcription of musical sound by computer. It is producing a score from a musical performance. And boy, using the computers of the day in 1975, that was a job. That was a serious job. Sure, it would all be much easier now. From there, within the music group, it was an incredible time, because this was the early days of digital audio, and just about anything we did was novel and was publishable. And just about any funny noise you could make, you could write a paper on it, and it would be something interesting, something that people wanted to read. So it was a wonderful time. As I say, everything we did turned to gold in a sense. That is, it helped composers make better pieces. It helped us understand hearing better. It was a glorious time. So I guess I had built up enough street creds by 1980, when George Lucas formed the computer division, that I was the first name that popped up for the audio side of it. And I had a nice little project running there for some years in digital solutions to film sound. And I never got a film credit, but I have sounds in a number of films, like the asylum scene in Amadeus. I did some of the noise reduction work there. And a number of sound effects that Ben Burtt and Gary Summers used in the Raiders of the Lost Ark movies. Some of which was based on some fairly elaborate signal processing, but not strictly musical in nature. But when I was thrown the, I had indicated previously, you know, as I mentioned, they have the had the policy of promoting from within. I'd mentioned previously that I would want to, that I did want to do some music for films. I wasn't quite ready to volunteer for a film score then, but any kind of music cue where I could do electronic music, I would be up for. So this is the one that fell into my lap. So it's mostly mostly for being in the right place at the right time, and apparently with the right skill set.
The interesting thing is that there is a common thread between the people that I'm talking to and the fact that they were either currently or at some point musicians, but I'm not talking to any other PhDs. So you stand alone there. But I'll ask you what I asked them and said, so if you could give up all that and have one sold out concert tour, would you trade it all for that?
Nah, I'm not that, I've performed quite enough. Thank you. It was fun for a while, but that's not really my thing. I actually get much more enjoyment from, this is going to sound nuts, but I get much more enjoyment from sitting alone in a room, working with the computer. I find I can be, have much more freedom to, explore. I should mention that I have a new piece out. In fact, it's 13 minutes, and the debut of it was at the world premiere of it was at Stanford last October 4th. Wow. Based on a poem from a friend of mine, "The Man in the Mangroves Counts to Sleep." If you like, I'll send you a link to a stereo copy of it. Yeah, it was written for surround for multi-channel surround, but so the stereo version of it is sort of a poor substitute, but I think it gets the idea across. It's an imaginary landscape. Anyway, yeah. So I, as I say, I get much more enjoyment out of indulging my creative side here at the house. I'm not that much of an exhibitionist that I can really enjoy extended concert tour.
I'm assuming you've been in the theater and heard your deep note. Have you looked around to see if anybody knows it? It's yours.
Well, not only does nobody know it, at various times, other people have claimed it, which was also interesting. No, I don't make a big deal out of it. So, well, having said that, every time I give a big presentation, like a keynote presentation or something like that, I do play it first thing just to establish some identity.
As you should. So speaking generally about audio logos and sound logos and stagers and all that kind of stuff, why do you think that they are the good ones? Why do you think they are so powerful and so remembered for so few amount of time and notes?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I honestly don't know. As far as Deep Note goes, I absolutely deliberately designed it to knock you flat. I mean, it was as soon as it was mentioned to me, I knew exactly what I wanted to do, and I knew it would just, you know, stun everyone in the audience, at least the first time they heard it. And the others and the other composers, I don't know. I don't know what makes besides my obvious, you know, heavy-handed approach to it, I don't know what makes some of these more subtle ones so attractive. A friend of mine once said, "Where does the music happen? Is it in the musician? Is it in the score?" Well, his conclusion was no. It's in the listener. It's in the audience. That's where the music actually happens. So to explain why a piece has such attraction, you have to explain something about people, I think. And I'm not sure quite that I have any insight on that.
Can I have a name to that quote?
Yeah, that's Mike Hawley, Hawley, Michael Hawley. He just passed away from cancer a few months ago. He was one of my hires at Lucasfilm. He worked with us for a couple of years, and he worked at Next Incorporated, and then he went to the MIT Media Lab, worked with Todd Machover, the composer, and among other people. He was another one of these musical technical gadflies in the world. But I thought that was a great quote.
It's a great quote. Do you have other favorite audio logos that you like next to yours?
Yeah, I don't know about logos. There was an Apple commercial that came out a while ago that I absolutely adored. It was a three-note piano lick. Let's see if this is going to work. And then he made various counterpoints to it and built up a whole texture out of this three note motif. I thought that was absolutely brilliant.
That is brilliant. Can I ask you when you hear yours now, what do you think? Are you still critiquing it, or are you?
This last version that I did in 2014, I think I've taken that idea about as far as it can go. So I think I can say now that it is officially done. I did have some fun playing with it. That is, I tried longer versions of it where let's say the random lead up lasted. I had one version that was 5 minutes long. And then I sat down at my keyboard and just I retuned it to be the D natural on the piano keyboard. Normally it's a little bit high of a D, tried jamming to it. Tried a little free jazz first, and then tried a little boogie woogie, and that was sort of fun. But the piece as it is stands on its own. In 2014, we did three different versions of it, a 30-second, a 45-second, and a 1 minute. Of those, I think the 45-second one is the best. The 1 minute one, you start saying, you know, get on with it. And the 30-second one just doesn't build up quite long enough to convey the impact I wanted.
Well, I think you were quoted as saying there was you really wanted to update it. There were some things that.
Yeah. Well, my use of space, the spatialization in 1983 was a bit impoverished. They only had four channel sound systems, left, center, right, and surround. That is, both left and right surrounds were one channel. So it was nice to be able to do it in 7.1 and then the Dolby Atmos 9.1, which included two overheads. That was great fun. And then getting to use up to 80 voices. It's interesting because at some point, adding more voices didn't help. It just made it sound, if you have like 200 voices, then it sounds like white noise. It sounds like a storm outside or a vacuum cleaner or something like that. But 80 was about the limit. And that one, you could pick out individual voices every once in a while that would rise above the noise or would get unusually high or unusually low or something like that. And I thought that was a pleasant effect. I didn't want to lose that. The original was in 30 voices, and I thought that was a little thin.
That's just unbelievable. I mean, it's mind-boggling. It's been so powerful for so many years. You have any fun facts for us of things that you haven't talked about in the last 28 years about the reaction to it or the creation of it or funny things that happened to you on the street? When
Disturbing email there are some people that are absolutely terrified by it, and that when they hear it coming on in the theater, they plug their ears up and bury their head in their lap until it's over. That wasn't wasn't exactly what I was planning for. Yeah, but I can see how it might happen. Another one was very funny, which was that one of my friends commented that his dog went crazy every time the thing came on. There was one nasty little secret in the first one, that if you actually, in the original, if you actually look at it on a spectrum analyzer of some kind, you'll see there's quite a bit of high frequency material in there. That's because to even get 30 voices, I had to cut some corners, and it produced a bunch of high frequency hash that is not really audible. But if you put it on an analyzer, it pops right up. And I think that's what the poor dog was hearing. Some stuff in the 15 to 18 kilohertz region.
That is too funny. Anything else you'd like to share with us before I let you go? And things that you're working on now that we can look for?
Well, I'm a little burned out from the Man in the Mangroves piece that I did. So I'm probably not going to do anything again for a while. But I would like to take the one of the things I've been thinking about for about 40 years is doing the Richard Brautigan poem, All Looked Over by Computers of Loving Grace. And I think the time is right. I've got the technology now, the speech synthesis and the voice synthesis, that I think I could do a good treatment of it. So yeah, I'd like to do that sometime.
That's great. We'll look for that. And I can't tell you how much, what a pleasure it's been to talk to you today.
Okay. Well, thanks for thinking of me, and be sure and let me know when your book comes out.
You've been listening to Marketing Musicology with Dr. David Allen.